Hey there, hope you all had a good Christmas. This is Jim Brown again with another Outrigged Capercast. This is the audio update for Chapter 3 in my book Among the Multi-Hulls, and it's where I came into the multi-hull fold. Now, just to make sure we've got the sequence right, I should mention that the book and these audio updates start at the zenith of the story, as they say. You know, maybe the best part, which in my view was building Scrimshaw and taking off on our family cruise. But the whole story starts well before that. So the next last chapter 2 was the story of my making that promise to myself to be a dedicated boat nut. And this one, the next last chapter 3, is, oh my, Arthur Piver, who, when writing about himself, always called himself the Skipper. I've said a lot about Arthur Piver in previous podcasts. He's credited with being the father of the modern trimaran. And yes, I knew him well. We worked together and sailed together for a couple of years there in the late 1950s and early 60s. Now, I've had some interesting feedback from some of you listeners who have said that you like the deep history. So in this audio afterword to Chapter 3 of Among the Multi-Hulls, I'm going to try to set the stage a bit more for a story that you may have already heard, but let's go a little deeper, okay? I'm going to try again to place the modern multi-hull into the context of the times in which it emerged. It's been over 10 years since the close of World War II, and the economy is really jumping, and there's a lot of optimism around. Americans figured that we could do anything with our wealth and our will. Now, let me emphasize that the catamaran came first in modern times. Personally, I think the trimaran came first in ancient times. But by the time Arthur Piver enters the multi-hull stage, Woody Brown and Rudy Choi and their followers had already been to sea in very significant ways with their modern catamarans. And by the time Arthur Piver started playing with first a catamaran, Skip Krieger-designed beach cat-like catamaran, the British Pratt Brothers had already developed the Shearwater catamaran, which is the real predecessor to the Hobie Cat. And we must not forget Victor Chechet, who had played with small trimarans on Long Island Sound back as early as the late 1940s. But for the most part, those boats just didn't have it. You know, they wouldn't come about, they wouldn't sail to windward, you couldn't steer them downwind, and they had the great propensity to dive the lee bow. So it was Arthur Piver who first put enough buoyancy in the forebody of a trimaran's outrigger hulls so that if the sailor were to hike out as far aft as possible, you could really push the boats. They had a real centerboard and a real rudder, so they maneuvered just fine. So the basic configuration of the modern trimaran was established by the time I showed up in about 1957. I rolled into the San Francisco area from New Hampshire on my motorcycle. I had come to visit with my folks who were living in Orinda, North Bay at the time. I hadn't seen them in a couple of years of my schooner bumming in the Caribbean. And as per my agreement, my arrangement with Wolfgang and Jeannie, I was to come to some place where I could get a job working in fiberglass. We wanted to build ourselves a boat, and we figured that the new material, fiberglass, would be the way to do it. Well, my dad, who had left his G-man days and gone to work in New York City in public relations and worked his way up, was now the vice president of Safeway Stores, and their headquarters were in Oakland, California. When I told Dad what I was up to, he went to work and asked around if any of his colleagues were into sailing. And they were told about a guy whose name I don't remember, but who was pivotal for me. I don't know, he was a bean counter of some kind, and he worked in a windowless office down in the catacombs of this huge building in Oakland. They told me to go see him, and he told me about the Coleman Boat and Plastics Company in Sausalito making the first large fiberglass boats in the United States. Well, many thanks to that guy, if he's still around. I went over to Sausalito and promptly got myself a job. I commuted the 60 miles from Orinda to Sausalito on my motorcycle for a while, but that got pretty old. So I found myself a place to live in Sausalito on a hard-scrabble little houseboat. I was learning a lot at work and loving it, so it didn't matter much where I had a place to sleep. And this houseboat was located at what they called Gate 3, the very northern end of the Sausalito shipyard that had emerged during the war, where for 2 miles all along the waterfront they had a huge operation building thousands of landing craft and many Liberty ships for all those campaigns in the Pacific during World War II. And my houseboat had been made out of a landing craft, a small one. It had a couple of bunks and a little dinette and a little galley, and you had to go outside, but on the stern of this thing there was a literally an outhouse that, of course, flushed straight into the bay. Now, you may have heard this before, but I'm trying to set the scene here. My little houseboat was just one of dozens of derelict vessels that were pulled up along the Sausalito waterfront. They included everything from little houseboats like mine all the way up to giant ferry boats that had been disused and discarded since the opening of the Golden Gate Bridge in like 1925. And this place, having been a shipyard, had, you know, wharfingers' houses and night watchmen's places out on these derelict wharfs that were rotting and falling in. And after the war, the land itself had reverted to its original owners, which were a couple of old drunk Portuguese fishermen, the Arquez brothers. And after a little interview, the Arquez brothers would let practically anyone show up with a big extension cord and a roll of garden hose and go out there and fix himself a place to live in one of these, you know, really ramshackle vessels or structures on the old shipyard wharfs. And this little Gate 3 area had a community going. Gradually, I began to get to know my neighbors. There were a couple of great big ammunition barges moored out there. They would sit in the mud at low tide. An ammunition barge is a floating, covered warehouse. They were used for carrying ordnance out to the ships, and they still are. They have just the same barges today at the Navy Weapons Station here at Yorktown, Virginia, not far from where I live. Only now, of course, they're carrying nuclear weapons out to the ships. But back in Sausalito, these barges, which were very well built and sturdily covered with a serious structure, they could be made into wonderful homes. Sometimes two or three families could be accommodated. Well, one of the ammunition barges at Gate 3 was owned by Bev and Thad, a nice young couple with kids, and they both had straight jobs in the city and went off, commuted every morning, just lived in Sausalito because they figured it was not only the cheapest, but the best place to live because it had this beautiful view of San Francisco Bay, and you could look across the Golden Gate and see the city lighting up at night. It was a very cool situation. The other barge was owned by Barney and Fran. Barney West was a chainsaw sculptor. He got great big redwood butts from the loggers and would carve them up into tiki forms, and he had a lot downtown where he sold these things. Had a little electric chainsaw for doing his sculpture in soft redwood. Very effective. And Barney's wife, Fran, was the local be good to the fellows gal. You know, the place became quite complete with her around. And sitting on the wharf itself was an old watchman's cabin. Not a cabin, but a thrown-up World War II habitation for somebody that had to live in the shipyard. It was really just a plywood box, I guess about 16 feet by 32 feet, with a decent roof and a few windows and a door or two. And it was occupied by friends Don and Moira Cogut, K-O-G-U-T. Don Cogut turned out to be instrumental in the modern multi-hull emergence. And I had my dear old friend Russell Miller living with me on the houseboat, and Don and Russ Miller and I began to play pranks on one another. Don and Moira's house was just sitting on the wharf on blocks. It was irresistible. Miller and I went over there one night with a big jack and a big timber, and we took the blocks out from underneath the corner of the house where Don and Moira slept. We had to be very quiet about it. And we reinserted a big long timber of about the same thickness as the blocks, set the house back down just on the very end of the timber, got the motorcycle over against Don's house, right outside their bedroom window, started it up, revved it, pounded on the wall, hollered, "Earthquake! Earthquake!" Pulled the timber out from under the house. The house went... We hopped on the bike and were on the way out of gate 3, and the last thing I saw was the door opened and Don was standing there in his underwear with his pistol going, "Blam! Blam!" I remember flames leaping out of this thing. Well, he got us back, man. He found himself a rotten salmon and slipped it into our bilge in a place where it was impossible to get to it without taking the place apart. It got smellier and smellier, and Miller and I were looking for another place to live along about the time they had the earthquake in Alaska. The boat was up on blocks. The way they did it is at low tide they would arrange for timber, a timber bunk to receive the boat that was at a very high tide level, and when the high tide came along they'd float the boat in on top of the bunk, let the tide go out, and open up the scuttle plug in the bilge of the boat so that if another high tide came along that high, it wouldn't float the boat off of its blocks. Instead, it would flood the bilge and keep the vessel from coming off of its bunks. Well, this worked just fine until they had that terrible earthquake in Alaska. I'm guessing that it was about 1958. And it caused a tsunami wave to come all the way down the Pacific coast of Washington, Oregon, California. And when that wave went past the entrance to San Francisco Bay at the Golden Gate, it flooded into the bay all right, and it caused the tide to come up very high, very fast. And it floated my little boat off of its blocks, and the poor thing drifted out into the bay, and then the tide went out fast, leaving miles of mud flats. And when it came back in, my poor little houseboat was not in a position to float. It had its scuttle plug pulled, and so it sank, and I was looking for another place to live. There was no doubt that I wanted to stay in Sausalito, even though my job was a bit tenuous at times. The Coleman Boat Factory would occasionally run out of money and bounce paychecks off of us and leave us 2 or 3 weeks to, have a good time while they set about refinancing. During one of these languid periods, I spent a lot of time with Don Kogut in the morning. His wife, Moira, got up and got on the bus and went over to San Francisco every morning, where she worked as a waitress at a fancy hotel. Don was a sometimes yacht broker. But we would often sit around all morning and drink coffee and tell lies. And from his yacht brokerage, he was able to pick up all of the out-of-date yachting magazines and bring them home. So he was much more up-to-date than I was about what was going on in multi-hulls. He fed me one article after another to bring me up to speed about what had happened with Woody Brown and Rudy Choi, some tremendous voyages between Hawaii and California in those early catamarans. And on one such occasion, when Don and I were trying to tell "Can You Top This?" stories, I told him about my experience with Wolfgang down in Cartagena, Colombia, building a trimaran out of oil drums. And Don, not to be outdone, said, "Oh, well, that's nothing. We have a man right here in Mill Valley who's experimenting with trimarans, and let's go downtown, see if we can find him." So Don and I were downtown Sausalito, standing on the old ferry dock where the ferries used to come in from San Francisco, and that dock was so rugged that it at that time housed the Safeway store. So you could still go out onto this very substantial wharf and lean against the railing and watch the water go by. And Don and I were there, I don't know, maybe we had another cup of coffee, and he said, here he comes now. And I looked up and saw this little boat coming down along from the north end of Richardson Bay. Richardson's is that bay that is an arm of the San Francisco Bay that's sort of separated from the rest of it by the Tiburon Peninsula and Angel Island. It's a beautiful little enclave. Just you go in the Golden Gate and turn hard left, you go up into Richardson's Bay. And we were looking out on that. It's a really a wonderful thing because Sausalito, the town, is stacked up on a steep hill that goes up over to the west toward the seaside, and that ridge really shoulders back the Pacific Ocean and all the fog and stuff, bringing Sausalito quite often a wonderful climate when the rest of the Bay Area is socked in. So there were spots of sun and spots of fog, and along came this little sailboat, and Kogut hollered out, "Hey, Art!" And Piver came over close to us, sailed over close to us, going very slowly in very light airs. And I had a look at this boat. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. It was a double outrigger canoe with a little platform on it. The main hull looked like a much too skinny boat, and the floats looked like, I don't know, coffins for big snakes. The thing was painted a terrible mixture of yellow house paint. The mast was, I later learned, made from a TV antenna, and the sails had been stuck together, Mylar film stuck together with Scotch tape. They rattled terribly when they luffed. But Piver came bopping along, talking to Don, saying, "Yeah, I just built this one, and it only cost me $200. And then a little Zephyr would find the boat, and it would jump ahead. And pretty soon he was out of sight around the corner. So we went down back onto the main street and out again at the Glad Hand restaurant, where we were able to watch Piver approach that area they call Hurricane Gulch, which is now a very fancy Sausalito neighborhood. But the fog comes rolling over the ridge and comes down in great big balls. And as it descends, you can see it getting ready to hit the water, but it disappears because the atmospheric pressure increases and the dew point goes away. The fog disappears, but the wind hits the water and it turns it to froth. Froth, man, willowas. And Piver was headed right for this thing, you know. Don and I was holding my breath, and the first gust that caught that little boat, it went off like a rocket into the fog. I'll never forget it. It reminded me of throwing a really good paper airplane, you know, one of those dart-like gliders. I had never seen a sailboat move like that, of course, and it just blew me away. I said, hey, how do I get a hold of that guy? And that following weekend, Piver and I went for that sail that I've told you about. We went out to the potato patch and all of that stuff. Came in surfing the freighter wake. That whole story happened not long after I first saw Arthur Piver from the old ferry wharf in Sausalito, about 1957. Well, Arthur Piver was a very amiable guy. He worked in a small publishing business that he had inherited from his father in San Francisco, and when he came home from work in his business suit, he seemed, you know, normal enough, and his wife and family in a beautiful home there in Mill Valley, just above Sausalito. But when you got him out into a boat, he was a madman. And this extended into the little houseboat community there at Gate 3. There was another guy there named Peter Vandelinde, who had another little barge that had a deck house on it, and he was living on that, and he offered me space on his barge for building my first Arthur Piver designed 16-foot Frolic trimaran. And oh, there were other real characters around. I remember particularly Ralph and Barbara Stein. I worked with Ralph at Coleman's, and they had a very hard scrabble set up there at gate three. They had a great little kid named Peter Stein. Peter, who became quite a sidekick of mine. We hung around a lot together. He was about five. Now and then, Ralph would come to me after work and say, "Hey, we haven't got anything to eat for dinner. You got to get us some dinner tonight." And I'd go downtown on my motorcycle and come back with bags of stuff, and we'd whip up some dinner. And Peter learned to call me by my full name, Jim Brown. He felt that that was one word. I'll tell a story here. It's off color. I was downtown in the bakery one day. We could buy great bread in Sausalito, and Barbara Stein was in line ahead of me, and Peter was there, and he was running in and out looking at the cookies in the case, you know. "Mommy, I want a cookie." "Sorry, Peter, no cookies today." He'd go outside and stomp around, come back in. "Mommy, I want a cookie." Well, this went on several times, and Barbara finally spoke harshly with him and said, "Peter, you've got to stop bothering me. We cannot afford a cookie today." And so Peter said, "Well, fuck you, Mommy," and turned around and went outside. God, everybody in line just shrank, you know, poor Barbara. Much later, I learned that Peter Stein lost his eyesight completely. And this houseboat community aspect pervaded on downtown for 2 miles of all this junk and old ferry boats and stuff, potato barges and lumber schooners. There were hundreds of people squatting in these places. Well, we paid a little rent to the Arquez brothers. Those who could would buy their habitation from the Arquezes. And working southward along the waterfront from Gate 3, then to Gate 5, famous place now. This was long before the Whole Earth Catalog had their offices on Gate 5 Road. Down in there was Juanita's Galley Restaurant. The food was great, but Juanita was nuts. She finally ended up in jail. She was always fighting with the authorities. There was a distillery on the other side of the highway. Good old Duckenheimer's blended whiskey. They put out a lot of mash-smelling steam at night. Then there was the old Mold Loft building, a building that had big, like, bigger than basketball court floors for laying out the shapes of the frames for the ships. That is actually lofting the ships by hand on these floors in the Mold Loft building. By then, the home of many small businesses, including a good sailmaker. And then there was the San Francisco Bay Model, another great big building with a model of the whole bay, a hydrological study model. They could actually flood this thing and watch the way the tide ran around the obstructions. Then the old Madden and Lewis shipyard, now a yacht harbor. And tied up in there was a thing they called a balloon barge, about a 50-foot steel whale of a boat, big thing shaped like a bar of soap, all made very lightly out of welded steel. It was used for mooring balloons that were used for surveillance, altitude surveillance, during some of the Pacific battles. And this balloon barge had been partly made into a habitation, and so a friend of mine, Dick Persoff, and I, Dick and I worked together, crazy Russian Jew. He and I rented the balloon barge, and I was living downtown there. And all this time, Piver and I and Piver's other friends, he had several disciples that had little boats of his design, and we'd all go sailing, just had a hell of a good time. His great friend was Fred Jukic, who became a great friend of mine too, another guy who was half nuts, but really willing to put himself out there and do things. He had a sign shop up at the seaplane base. And in that sign shop, Fred had built himself a 20-foot trimaran. Piver designed him something a little bigger than the Frolic, which was 2 sheets of plywood lengthwise at 16 feet. Another half a sheet of plywood gave them a 20-footer, and so Jukic built this really rocket ship trimaran. He called it Jukebox. And man, the thing was a very powerful boat. And so we really had somebody to sail against when we went out there. By now, Piver was playing with a little catamaran he called Pie Cat. and he wanted the lightest weight crew man he could find, and that turned out to be Don Cogut. And so Piver and Cogut were often out there charging around the bay when we had our frolics and Jukic his jukebox. And this is a very active yachting center now. You know, every decent weekend there are literally hundreds of boats out on San Francisco Bay all the time. It's probably the windiest, you know, yachting center in the world. And with the Golden Gate there, you can find conditions that are as much adrenaline as you want. Living downtown Sausalito there, I had a chance to meet a guy named Peter Clausen. He was a skier, and I had skied at Dartmouth. We had something to talk about. And he told me that the 1960 Winter Olympics were to be held at a place called Squaw Valley up in the Sierras. And he'd gone up there and bought some property, and he wanted to build some houses to get ready for the Olympics, and asked me if I wanted to go. Well, it was hard to leave Sausalito. Right across the little slough where the balloon barge was located, there was another houseboat that was home to the Kingston Trio. They were right out of Stanford and Berkeley, and they were becoming popular because they had a steady gig at a place called the Purple Onion in San Francisco. We used to go over there and listen to them sing. Very energetic group. And they did all of their practicing on the veranda of their houseboat, which was right across from where I lived, and so I kind of liked living there. There was all kinds of stuff going on in that shipyard, very creative. The artist Varda was there, and he was a really wonderful old guy. Had a lot of disciples, too, a lot of followers, and they got a hold of a big whaleboat-like thing and turned it into a Viking ship. And it had shields and flags and stuff all over. And they'd go sailing around out there in Richardson's Bay. It was quite a show. Then after a day on the water, Varda would like to invite as many as he could handle to come to his place for dinner. And he always fixed something very interesting. Boy, that's where I learned to love sweetbreads. That guy could really cook. There was the Heathware Pottery Manufacturing Company there at the time, very upscale ceramicists, and some of the local people worked there at Heath. Another couple who were also wonderful potters, Dave and Helen Morris, they were off there in the shipyard. And it was time for music, a lot of music and partying. You could get a whole gallon of Red Mountain wine in a big glass jug for $1. It was pretty brash stuff, but we peed away a lot of it. And I was not musical, but I loved to go and listen. These houseboat hoots attracted talent from the city. But finally, my job at Coleman really did peter out. They went belly up. So I joined with Peter Clausen. We went up to the Sierras, to Squaw Valley, and built houses winter and summer. And boy, up there, I'll tell you, it can really snow. I've seen it snow 3 feet overnight. Snowflakes the size of potato chips. So, of course, the buildings there had to be very robust in order to tolerate the snow loads. And Peter teamed up with an architect whose name was Henrik Bull. And Henrik said, there's only two ways to handle these snow loads. You got to make the roofs steep enough so that the snow will slide off of them. And as incidentally, they got to slide off of the roof and away from the house. They can't pile up between the house and the hillside, or else they'll push the house over. Either that, or you got to build them dead flat and make them strong enough to take it. You know, if you get 4 or 5 feet of snow on the roof and then it starts to rain, there's a lot of weight involved. So Peter and I build houses out of snow shed timbers, massive framing with roofing that was built like a mill floor, you know, 2x4s and 2x6s on edge, stacked up all the way across the roof. And I had found a little place to rent in Tahoe City, split it up with several other fellows that were building houses up there too. And at one Christmas time, everybody went away for the holidays except me, and I was hanging around, and I had bought a Christmas gift for the Clausens, Peter and Joan. It was a phonograph record, you know, one of the old LP platters, of the Kingston Trio. And there was a song on there that I hadn't heard them sing before. Oh, man. I wonder if you've heard it. I shouldn't try. I shouldn't even try to do this. But it goes something like this. Way up Susiana, Mexico is the place where I belong in. Round the Bay of Mexico. Gracious, I have the feeling I have subjected you to that before. But I had heard the tune before down in the Caribbean. That night at Old Providence Island when they had the moon sing. And of course the way they sang it was, way up Susiana, Providence is the place where I belongs in. I suppose it was Calypso that had moved around to many of the islands and they all just put their own name in it. Well, hearing that music in that little snowed-in cabin in the Sierras just really reached me, man. All of a sudden, I realized, what am I doing here up to my ass in snow? I want to go back to the Caribbean. And I was absolutely smitten with resolve to do just that. But I wanted to do it in my own boat, and I didn't have one. So I got to thinking about that crazy little frolic, how incredibly seaworthy it was, and then Fred Jukic's 20-footer, which seemed like a battleship compared to the 16-footer, and I thought, well, maybe instead of 2 sheets and then 2.5 sheets of plywood lengthwise for determining the length of the vessel, 16 feet or 20 feet in the case of Fred's boat, jukebox, how about using a full 3 sheets, a 24-footer? Now, that thing gets to be, you know, probably capable of a coastal voyage. I wouldn't have to carry a lot of stuff, ha ha, I thought. I could get supplies, any number of stops, you know, seaports and villages all down the western seaboard on the way to Panama. And if I were to get caught out in really bad weather, I could always, you know, head for the beach. Now, up to that time, we had just been playing around with these little 16-foot trimarans. So while listening to the Kingston Trio and looking at 5 feet of snow out the window, I thought, man, if we could put 3 full sheets of plywood together, that'd give us 24 feet, a whale of a boat compared to what we were accustomed to. So I went back down to Sausalito and approached Arthur Piver with the notion of a 24-footer. And he said, well, as a matter of fact, we've already got one. While I was up in the Sierras, he had designed a 24-foot, four-place, open day sailor for a guy named Carlton Eugene, who lived over in San Francisco. He was an auto upholstery man. Well, I contacted Carlton, and he took me out for a sail. And I was really flabbergasted by the performance of this thing. It was literally just a great big frolic, crudely built. But looking it over, I thought, all I would need is just a little cuddy cabin on that thing, not even closed up at the back end, just something to get down out of the wind and spray. I think I've explained before that Piver and I both had schooner experience. We each knew something of seamanship outside of recreational day sailing on San Francisco Bay. So I said, Art, what would you think if I put a little cuddy cabin on the forward end of that open cockpit and took off down the western seaboard for Panama? He did not laugh. He sat and thought for a while, and he finally said, well, Jim, you know what you're doing. You could probably sail a boat like that anywhere. Now, those of you listeners who have asked for the deep history, that's as deep as I can go into the modern trimaran. Of course, we now realize that the inherent rightness of the double outrigger canoe had long since been proven by, you know, a couple 3,000 years. So there really is nothing new under the sun, just recombinations of old ideas. In this case, it was the combination of the ancient double outrigger together with, you know, plywood and fiberglass and nylon. And of course, because of the light weight and high strength and much larger, more efficient sail plans than were being used by the ancient people, the modern trimaran required some redesign. You know, stronger crossbeams and better connectives. Much more buoyancy in the outrigger bows. Some real lateral resistance in the shape of the centerboard. And a true vertical axis articulating rudder, which the Pacific people never had. Personally, I like to think that that remark by Arthur Piver, you know, you could probably sail a boat like that anywhere. That moment is the inception of the modern double outrigger canoe, as applied to offshore seafaring. So, I had made a little money in the Sierras, came back down in the spring, rented space in Fred Jukic's sign shop, and began to build my nugget. And you know the rest of the story. Before I got her finished, of course, I bumped into Joanna. One thing led to another, and I'll have to tell you about it next time. I hope you can remember this current half hour of scene setting, and I'll try to join that with the moral revolution of the 1960s and use that to place into some context the explosive, controversial, countercultural advent of the modern seafaring multi-hull. Till then, I hope you all have a safe and happy new year, and I'll see you next year. Bye-bye.